Today's show is a recording of a What in God's Name gathering held on December 12th, 2022 on Zoom. Our special guest for this interactive gathering was Alyssa Rossoff, humanist chaplain at the women's prison in Raleigh, North Carolina. Alyssa had been a recent guest on our podcast and agreed to come back for this event. Our essential question is, can humanist chaplaincy be a model for public conversations? Listen for the different skills that a chaplain needs in order to effectively be with people, and try to connect those skills with a vision of how we can learn to do better with each other in our plural public square. Listen also for different metaphors of gathering and relating to people. The metaphor of the circle, being at the table, storytelling, metaphors that help us visualize healthy ways for people with diverse needs and desires to be together. Finally, bring your critical skills. What are the limitations of chaplaincy as a model for public conversations? How are the challenges of dealing with conflict in our shared common life, for example, not met by this model? We at What in God's Name are grateful to have you with us for today's show. First of all, welcome to us all to this gathering with Alyssa Rossoff, humanist chaplain. I'm Chris Owen, one of three hosts. Let me introduce my teammates, Shayna Appel and Brandon Edwards. I want to say a few things about the What in God's Name project and then turn it over to Alyssa. And then Alyssa is going to set the table for us and then we'll move into conversation. What is the What in God's Name project? We believe that lots of good and healthy things can happen in our shared common life when we reframe public questions using theology and moral philosophy, rather than the usual frames of partisan politics and economics. That is a dense statement. Let me try to unpack it a little bit with three of the assumptions and working definitions that we use. First, public space is bigger than political space. Our gathering, this little Zoom, is public space. And part of this conversation, what does it mean to be human together, is a public conversation. So we embrace, this is the second piece of our project. We embrace pluralism and see it as a strength of our shared common life, not a threat. Some people see pluralism as a threat. So I'm a Christian. Shayna comes to this as a Unitarian Universalist. Alyssa comes as a humanist chaplain to this conversation. We all may give different accounts of human dignity. We may tell different stories about how that is, that we all share human dignity. But that's our connection. We're connected in affirming human dignity in a way that our political and economic ways of thinking and ways of ordering our public life at this moment do not do very well. And then the last thing I want to add, a third piece of our assumptions and working definitions, is that we believe that if we engage with these questions of human dignity first, like if we ground public conversations, our shared common life, if we ground our thinking and our conversations in this idea of human dignity, we can have, it's not like that's going to lead to the proverbial kumbaya movement moment where everybody's in agreement. Rather, we believe that if we ground our conversations there first, we can have more fruitful disagreement. Our disagreements will become more fruitful. And eventually, I mean, our vision is that eventually we can have a healthier public life, including our politics. So That is the What in God's Name Project, and that is the spirit in which we gather and have Alyssa with us. Alyssa, your turn. I'd like to turn it over to you to give us some context for the work that you do and how you think about what you do and your work and ministry. Do you think of it as a ministry? I guess would even be, I use that word, but carry on.
Yes. So as Chris mentioned, my name is Alyssa Rossoff, and I'm a humanist endorsed clinical professional chaplain living in Durham, North Carolina. And I mostly work in Raleigh at the Raleigh Women's Prison, and then in some residences that are part of a women's reentry program here in Raleigh named Arise Collective. And what you said about ministry, do I even use that word? It's the same with the word chaplain, right? We think about where did these words come from? And a lot of it is semantics. And for some people, it's very important to use the right word choice and know where words are coming from. For me, I use the term ministry all the time. I use the term I serve, even though that does come from a lot of Christian language, being a servant of the Lord. So it's important that I know where these terms are from that I use so frequently. But to me, the term ministry does describe what I do. And a lot of what I do as a chaplain is having one-on-one conversations with people. And that, I think, is where our spheres are overlapping today. What you're doing with your project and what I do with my work is providing people with a safe space to share their narrative, to share their story, and suspend any gut reaction, bias, or judgment that I might have simply by being a human and growing up in a certain society. I have judgment, but a lot of my work is learning how to suspend that and then learning, okay, what would an appropriate level of self-disclosure be in this conversation where I'm a care provider and I'm working with a care recipient? And the training that a clinical professional chaplain undergoes has a lot to do with human development, psychology, mental health, study of religion, so that I can be well prepared and well equipped to meet people where they're at based on their own religious and faith-based identities. And so that's why I do think it's a phenomenal framework for how to engage in public dialogue in a way that's fruitful and healthy. And I don't want to hog too much of the time just talking, but I'll open it up for any specific questions people might have about how my work as a humanist chaplain has anything to do with public dialogue.
One of the most surprising.
This is Shana, What in God's Name creative co-collaborator and co-host.
For those listeners who don't know, ministers who are lettered in the sort of mainline churches have to undergo an element of our ministerial formation that is called clinical pastoral education, which Alyssa would have done 6 units of CPE. That's a level of gluttony for punishment that I won't get into. But in the 1 unit of CPE that I did, there were the thing that was most surprising was, of course, first we came in thinking we were there to primarily to help others, that was what that first unit of CPE was all about. And what I learned was the first unit of CPE was really about learning to get out of the way and to develop a sense of a self-awareness, really. My CPE supervisor used to like to say, you know, the people who we're working with are in the river of poop. And lining the banks of the river of poop are well-meaning individuals with ladders and life preservers and self-help books and life rafts and all manner of things to help people to get out of the river of poop. But what our job is to get into the river with people until they're ready to get out on their own. And so, you know, that unit of CPE really became largely about learning what stops us from getting into the river. And as you were talking, that whole thing came back to me, and I started to think, you know, maybe that is ministry in its purest form, is that authentic connection when one or both people can get all of our assumptions and the mind monkeys and everything else, we can get them out of the way so that we can have this authentic connection. Because I feel like maybe that transcends the notion of ministry as being grounded in any particular school or the property of any ministry, but really an invitation to talk about the deepest things we know right away, regardless, and to do what we can to remove so that there is an authentic, remove the mishigas so that there is an authentic connection.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And, you know, we started this conversation talking about the word ministry and do we even use that? And so me loving the dictionary, I had to look it up. And to minister to is also to attend to the needs of.
Mm.
So what you just described is a lot of what chaplaincy is, attending to the spiritual and or religious and or emotional care needs of another human being. And the clinical pastoral education, the CPE units Shana was talking about, that yes, I did six of, was ready to graduate. But the core component, the foundational component of any unit of CPE is group processing, where all of the students gather in a circle, and it does seem very kumbaya moment, but what it is just talking, just sharing as feelings come up, even in the live moment, learning how to confront people respectfully who you disagree with, or you think that they might be doing something that's harming others. It's a place designed to learn the skills of disagreeing and agreeing and everything in between in a way that is healthy and respectful. And so I remember saying to myself, I think I was older when I first started, like 28 years old. And I said, gosh, if only I had had group processing in high school, my life would be easier. And it's not that it's easier, but it just arms you with the tools and the skills to be able to enter into spaces in which there's disagreement. And hopefully you are able to enter into spaces in which there's disagreement, because we all know the dangers of surrounding yourself with people who think and believe exactly like you.
So in that spirit, if I may, twice already this morning, I noticed we've invoked the kumbaya moment, and that's a sensitive one for me. So I'll just put that out there, because I know the term and I know sort of how it's used in the current lexicon is to sort of poke fun at or to make light of this maybe a quasi sort of connection. But I also know where its roots come from out of the Black tradition. And so when it gets poked fun of, I get a little weird. So I just throw that, I'm putting that out there. You guys can do with it what you will.
Thank you.
Shana, I appreciate that. I appreciate that very much. And I won't do it again.
Appreciate you guys.
And if I do it again, call me again. But I should.
Ginger boy, when do you do anything that I don't call you out on? Thanks, guys. Thanks for hearing that. I appreciate it.
Shana, that really is an example of how something in the live moment that made you feel uncomfortable, you were able to share with us, and we can grow and learn and recognize that, yes, I believe kumbaya means come by or come be here. And so to think about, okay, yeah, it's really been taken out of context when people are in a way, making fun of community.
Yeah.
And so you sharing that in live moment helps us all to learn and grow and think twice before.
And so I really want a better word. I also really want a better, I really want a better expression for that pseudo, because you know, we encounter it and I don't have a term for it. So that'll be your homework, guys.
And probably a lot of that has to do with when people are asked to just come together and love each other without attending to the grief in the room or the discomfort or the places of contention. That's where people poke fun of it, because it's like, you can't just force us all to love and sing together. Yes. When there's all this happening inside. Right. That's very much a part of this work too, making space for the discomfort, even though we're society's saying, just, you know, get along, people. Why can't we just, we can't just snap our fingers and get along.
Which gets to, and I'm just going to ask one more question and I promise I'll shut up. Chris and I have talked, there's 1,001s to frame what I'm about to say. And I'm framing this with a really broad brush, in a way that we have framed it with a really broad brush before on our show. So longtime listeners will understand the context of what I'm about to say. And that is that it seems to me that the fundamental question that religion seeks to answer is the question of how shall we get along? And then many religions have, it seems, sometimes gone out of their way to screw that up, to do everything in their power to break connection, you know, with people they disagree with, or people, what, I don't know, you all understand where I'm going with that. My question for you is that, how does that frame apply to humanism? Does it apply to humanism? And if so, how? How does a humanist work out some of that stuff?
So to make sure I understand, how does a humanist make sense of humans wanting to get along? Or
are humanists fundamentally concerned with that? Is that a core, generally speaking?
Mm-hmm. Yes, that is definitely an inherent core value of humanism, because so many of the 10 commitments require other human beings, such as humility and altruism and social justice. We often think about ethical development and responsibility and caring, being stewards of the land as well. But a lot of that is self-serving, because we want our species to continue to exist here. So there's always humans behind the thinking. It's really hard to extract ourselves from our thinking, to get out of our own way, just as in any other philosophical or theological thought pattern. So empathy, responsibility, being aware of not only your own self and your unit, that of the people around you, whether they're in your home or your shared living space or your city or your town, but the entire world. Part of being a humanist, in my opinion, is being well informed about what's happening in the world, the macro, the micro, being a critical thinker. And the word humanism comes from human, and from putting an emphasis on human beings having inherent dignity, regardless of what they look like or think like or talk like. And I mentioned some of that in the podcast, so I don't want to repeat myself too much here, but all that to say that we have a lot of strong values and commitments about taking care of and being aware of the experiences of our fellow human beings. All that to say, we are only human, which means, you know, I can believe that and then come home and totally disrespect my husband. I joked about that on the podcast too, because that's probably where I struggle most, of doing the walking the walk, talking the talk in my job. It's much easier for me to treat my colleagues and care recipients with those deep humanist values, but can I bring those same values to the people that I'm most intimate with, who know me most deeply, and who I should be the most vulnerable with? And that can be very hard. So just like any other tradition, those are similar issues and obstacles and places for growth for me as a humanist chaplain.
Thanks. That's great.
Yeah. So if I may jump in.
Yeah.
This is Barbara, a participant in our gathering.
I would just like to go back to the circle again. I am a huge circle person, proponent. I practice the Circle Way. It's thecircleway.net is a great website. And as part of that, and I'm part of that community. And I had the benefit of working in circles and living in circles when I was young. Alyssa, similar to you, you went to a Montessori school. I went to a Waldorf school. And then I taught there. And then that was after being a nurse. So I've been in these caring positions. And now I'm an interfaith, interspiritual minister. And I'll share in a moment where I'm doing there. But I also think that the circle, whether I do it in the community or in prison or in the schools or wherever I am, when I'm in circle, when we're seriously gathered, whoever you are, and the intention is that we're there fully present, that we don't even have to have a candle lit. We're just there with all our authenticity, and to apologize when it gets rough and ugly, and to keep showing up to try to get it right. Like that example just was perfect for that kumbaya moment, that how to, when it's not working well, that we can have the courage to speak, right? And say, that was really uncomfortable. Can we reframe that or something? The way that I view it is that our actual DNA recognizes that when we are collectively in a circle together as beings, and that it goes back to our very beginning of existence. And there's something that rings so true in our being that we feel comfortable in that space, even if it's at the moment unfamiliar because you haven't done that before. But there's something very deep within our bodies that recognize that, which allows people to then, once the situation has been created, to speak very authentically from their place, and to speak their needs in their heart. So I have a homestead here in Temple, and it's called Avalon Healing Arts Barn Studio and Sanctuary. And Friday night, we just launched our women's group in our yurt with what's called the Green Tent Circle, which is just another one of these circles. This is an international circle of women and girls supporting each other and motherhood. And simply these people didn't, we didn't know each other, right? We walked in and we were strangers. And we walked out, and it was like loving family, you know, this connection that is beyond knowing, you know, how is this possible in this last hour that we're able to have this kind of deep connection? So when we're sitting in circle, the other thing I wanted to say was that if, when I do light my candle, or if I don't, then silently I will image that. It's that's when I invite spirit in. And I believe that when spirit joins that circle, or whatever you call your divine or the energy or source, when you invite that in to this human gathering, then something bigger than us happens. Something beyond what we ever thought was possible happens. I couldn't have been more excited when I heard you talking, Alyssa, because I have 11 years of experience at the New Hampshire State Prison for Men doing the Alternatives to Violence Project. But we were shut down a bunch of years ago because of lack of staffing, and I was ready to come back in. And they couldn't, they said, we still have not enough staffing. So when I asked what else I could do, they said, well, I asked the chaplain because I know him. I said, so what else can I do? I'm a chaplain now. Isn't there something I can do? They said, well, we need volunteers for all these different groups. And he said, you know, all the Catholics. And oh, he went through the whole list of all the religions. And then he said, the neo-pagans. I says, oh, great. Who is that? Yes, please. And so I've only, it's been 4 weeks and I've been meeting with them. And because the women's prison heard about this, they invited me up. So last week I went to meet with a women's prison for the first time and they want me to come as well. And so what I didn't know, which was amazing listening to you, is that you, your Arise organization is an outside organization that funds you to go in. And I think that's that sort of mind-blowing concept. So thank you. Yeah.
Barbara, I thought you looked familiar to me and I could not figure out from where, but I do think our paths crossed around prison work.
I know, actually, I know where they actually crossed on a motorcycle, Shayna.
Okay, boom, got it. I'm there now.
We were both bikers.
That happens.
It happens.
I still have my Harley.
I'll share when you were talking about your work in the prison and the group you said was called Neo-Pagan. Is that how they identify? Interestingly, most recently, a lot of my work has been advocating for the women who identify as Wiccan. And Wicca is how North Carolina prisons label and identify people kind of falling under any kind of pagan tradition, whether, you know, there are a lot of things that fit under that umbrella. The point being, using what we have to create what we need. And that is a lesson that really has helped me in all walks of life. What do we have? What are we working with? How can we? And sometimes that's just using another human's brain and talking and having conversation. And we needed a red candle and we cannot have candles. So I made one out of paper and a paper clip, and the flame was yellow paper and the back of a candy wrapper for some sparkle. And just thinking about how we can be savvy and again using our critical thinking skills. If someone says you can't have a candle, that doesn't mean that the whole Yule winter solstice celebration needs to be trashed. No, how can we combine? I asked some women if they wanted to utilize their artistic skills to draw things. So I think they're going to draw a Yule log and just, I mean, what can we do at the end of the day except for use what we have, but also advocate when people's rights are being trampled over? So that it's a very fine line of a dance between being a social justice advocate and also being an employee of the state and making sure that everything abides by policy. And so in this role as humanist chaplain or any kind of chaplain working in a sphere like corrections or public safety or the hospital, as professional chaplains, we first and foremost need to be aware of the framework that we're working inside of and doing our best to cause the least amount of harm, ideally zero harm. But like we saw earlier, we can, unbeknownst to ourselves, cause harm. And so being able to respond when people bring up something that harmed them in a way that's not defensive and try to be understanding and tap into compassion. And that comes up for me on a daily basis in my work, where someone shouts at me and asks why they haven't received what they asked for yet. And I take a breath and I really try to practice compassion and imagine what it would feel like to be waiting for weeks to see an obituary of a loved one or whatever it may be that a chaplain can help with in the prison setting. So
I do have a question. I want to circle back to one of the first things you said, Alyssa, about, and I appreciated your consideration of the question that's framing our gathering. Can humanist chaplaincy be a model for public conversations? And you identified suspending judgment as a way to really be able to engage with a person wherever he or she or they might be. And then, Barbara, as you were talking, this vision of the circle is a strong vision for me of a mental image of basically healthy space where human beings are connecting. And the more we can do that, the more we can do that, the better off we'll be. So all of that I mentioned. The other piece of the conversation that also relates to this, and I'll get to my question in a second. We did then talk about the ability to disagree. And Alyssa, you were talking about, you know, the group processing and how we learn in you know, CPE debriefings about how to disagree in ways that are productive. And that's the direction of my question is going, because if I think about chaplaincy as a model for public conversations, yes, I think there's a lot to be learned. Here's the question. What are the limitations of this chaplaincy model, of this circle model? What are the limitations if we think of our shared common life? And here's what I'm, and this is where I'm having difficulty even formulating the question. I'll try it. What happens when we run up against people who simply reject the value of conversation? So basically people who, to put it in the chaplaincy metaphor, people who reject the chaplain. And so, yeah, so that, so, and so, yeah, respond to that. I would love to hear you all respond to that, actually.
I really hope this doesn't get misconstrued, but the image that comes to mind for me, I make a strong parallel to, okay, I'm very nervous to say this, but recovery work. And I say that because I'm thinking about when I work with people in recovery from a bird's eye view, I might have an idea about what the healthiest, steps might be to achieve a healthy outcome. And yet what I'm prescribing may not work for that person. And until that person can identify and make meaning out of life for themselves in a way that works for them, they're not going to necessarily be open to evolve and change. And that process takes time. And so I don't mean to be offensive by using that metaphor. I just mean to say that if I'm having a very progressive liberal viewpoint about, let's just say, a person's right to choose what kind of health care they need for their body, then that's what I hope that I can have the autonomy to do for myself, and I can't necessarily make someone else change their mind. Now, if that other person who has a different perspective has a daughter who then is walking this journey and they see it firsthand, and then they might develop a deeper understanding of what it means to have autonomy over one's body, it's through that channel that they might be able to have a different understanding. And so I think there's no easy answer, but I do strongly stand by my belief that nobody can enforce or impose that someone changes. And where we come up against some friction often has to do with more dogmatic traditions where there's one way, and maybe that one way is considered an actual sacred document, and or fill in the blank, I'm just using vague examples here, but that it actually feels like harm is being done to a person if somebody says something different from what they believe. And that's kind of the religious pluralism you were talking about at the beginning, Chris, when there are definitely some people that do not believe in religious pluralism. But religious pluralism exists. But unless you go out into the world and see that and make friends and colleagues and build deep, trusting, respectful relationships with people who have different beliefs, it's going to be really hard to shift the narrative. And it can be hard as a humanist chaplain to work with people who are really set in a way that causes harm to others. And so that's a place where I can ask probing questions, but it's really not professional to tell someone that what they believe is wrong. So I would never do that. But anyone else have an answer?
You hope that stupidity gets whacked off people during CPE, but some people are resilient. They can carry that stupidity with them. I didn't find the metaphor around the recovery stuff offensive at all. I thought it was great. And so thanks for sharing that. It brought to mind an incident I had as a fire department chaplain where I was sent to the hospital to deal with a family member who was there of somebody who had died a traumatic death. So, you know, this is the very upsetting moment. Obviously, the woman's husband was a mess, and they had just sent me to the hospital to be with him. Okay. So when I got there, he was out in the parking lot, you know, making phone calls, and I'm the chaplain from the fire department. And he was like, basically like, you know, I don't have time for that right now. And I said, that's great. There's nothing you need to do other than to just know I'm here if you need anything. And then I went away and I went to the hospital. I made sure we had a family room set up and that they had stuff and that, you know, I was talking to the hospital was jammed, said, you want me to find out from the family who they're using as a funeral home? And so there was this goes back to what you said, or the definition of ministry, you know, is attending to the needs, right? And sometimes it's foot washing, not always some big holy ritual, what one might think of, you know, as ministerial. Sometimes, you know, being the minister at a church means you get to clean the toilets. And sometimes it means you're preaching before hundreds. You know, that's just the nature of the work. If you want to be of service to people, then you do kind of have to let go of your own ideas occasionally about what that looks like. And I don't know about you, but the longer I do this work, the more I am sure I don't have the answers.
This is Barbara, a participant in our gathering.
Going back to your question, I did quite a bit of studying with the United States Institute of Peace. And I remember something that a professor there said a long time ago. And, you know, I asked, like, how do you do this in foreign countries? How do you do it when the political systems are so hot and violent and deadly? How is this possible? And he said one of the most important things we can do with our circles and work and with our communities is trying to find a common goal. And it can be sometimes, like Liz was saying, you have to get way out here. You know, and maybe it's very general, like if you're talking about working inside a prison, the goal would be to get out, right? And so that is a general, that can be a shared goal. And then collectively, this group of very different human beings can agree on that being the center of this process. And then together, we begin to move forward. And this professor was saying that he's witnessed it like it was a miracle, that people who were literally at each other's throats, killing each other, could, once they had an active role, and much of this does the best when it's, you know, embodied, right? We physically go out and we do it.
Right.
And then we can have this experience together, and we recognize we're more than just the other. When we stop othering and then come to be with each other in this way that is constructive, that constructive seeing and being together, it fuels not the anger, it fuels the underlying love of what is binding us together, which we don't speak about.
You know, I took Chris's question slightly differently.
This is Brandon, What in God's Name associate producer.
In this conversation of a circle. And there's an assumption, I think, there. When I think of circle, I think of a table and having people have a seat at the table. And I took Chris's question, I mean, how do we get people who are otherwise not even interested in hearing or having a seat at the table at the table? And for me, I think sort of what motivates a lot of my own work is the importance of humanizing through storytelling. Mm-hmm. And what I mean by that is that I'll use climate change as an example, and this sort of builds, I think, a little bit off of Barbara's point as well. Many of our large-scale problems are, you know, to go back to Chris's beautifully articulated vision of what this project and podcast are for, are framed in political terms. Many of our big problems are framed in political terms, climate change being one of them. But when you tell the story of a group of people who may live completely across the world from you, whose homes are in danger because of fire, tsunami, hurricane, and hear that story told in their own words, not told by a politician, not told by someone who looks like me, but in their own words, it has power. And I'm reminded of I'm an ethnographer, so I'm reminded of a story that a professor of mine told on the first day of our ethnography class several years ago at the Harvard Graduate School of Education, which is that he was on his way across the country on a flight, and there was a woman on the flight who became very irritated, in part because she was intoxicated, and he was pretty ticked off with her by the end of the flight. And he got up at the end of the flight with the means of saying something to her, and he had the moment of recognition that I'm seeing the world through my eyes. I haven't seen it through hers. So he struck up a conversation instead, and she had described all the horror that she had been through with an illness that she was experiencing and was on her way across the country to get treatment for it. And essentially that changed his mind because he had not heard the world through her perspective. So I do think to the extent that we can humanize issues and do so through storytelling, it can bring people, it can soften their hearts and bring them to the table, bring them to the circle. Because one of my worries sometimes in my own work is, how do we get them to the table in the first place? So that's sort of my take on this very astute question.
That reminds me, the other day I was in a re-entry meeting, and one of the women who's active in politics in Raleigh and also has experienced incarceration said, if we don't have a seat at the table, we'll be on the table as the meal, and was very strong about ensuring that she had a seat at the table where policy was being written about all types of things that impacted her in actual life when she was pregnant and experiencing incarceration. So not old men talking about what should happen with pregnant women and as they're transported to the hospital, but her who had that experience. So thanks for bringing that up.
As they say, if you ain't at the table, you're probably on the menu.
Yes. Yeah.
That's a great one.
That's the actual quote.
Yeah.
And I'd also just like to, underscore the story. I mean, that really is so transformative, right? And many of our original, if we want to say, spiritual paths or religions were oral traditions, right? It was the story, it was the bard. And I happen to identify as a Christian that walks in earth-based tradition, and I identify as a Druid. And so story for us, story and music, is so healing and passing it on. And the really hard stories as well, the really dark ones, not to shy away from those. They are powerful. And all what we refer to as magic can be hidden within that if we choose to listen.
Yeah. If I may, go ahead. Go ahead, Alyssa.
No, I just quickly wanted to mention, because I know we're getting close to the end here, the Stitching Stories Women's Prison Awareness Quilt. And this is a project that was done here in North Carolina at the Minimum Security Unit at North Carolina Correctional Institute for Women. As they survived COVID in prison, they crocheted a quilt to tell their stories. And there were four original artists who interviewed over 60 women in their unit, and they put their stories in the quilt. And each color represents a different woman. Each square represents 1 year of incarceration. And each ribbon with a different color represents certain things that people have survived, such as having a loved one die while they were in prison, or domestic abuse, or leaving a child. And so when you look at this quilt, at first it's just this beautiful block of color and you're drawn in. But as you start getting closer and you start counting the squares and the ribbons that one individual has, and her few squares, she has 20 ribbons or 50 squares. That person has been in for 50 years. And it starts to tell the story in a way that is helping to raise awareness about the full picture behind each woman. And so that's a really big project that we're trying to grow with a big grant application due in January to Z. Smith Reynolds Foundation. And I'm the project manager on that. And that's part of our community engagement, is telling the stories through inclusive public art. So if you have time later, ipmforwomen.org/stitchingstories. And that goes to exactly what you're saying. How can we share the narrative in a way that is relatable to all people? Like a quilt, okay, a blanket. We all need our families, often like pass down quilts or blankets keep us warm. People love looking at colors. And then from there, seeing those things in common, getting closer and reading about the stories and hearing the women's stories recorded on the website. And it's just one way that we're trying to spread awareness without whacking people over the head with it and making them feel bad for not knowing before, if that makes sense. Trying to meet people where they're at.
Thank you for that, Alyssa. And this is a good moment for us to draw our time to a close. And so I thank you, Alyssa, once again for being our guest. And Barbara, we thank you for your presence with us and for this conversation. And I will just make this observation. The word, the phrase comes to mind, generative conversation, marked by listening and taking in what others have said and responding, building off of that listening. To me, that's generative, and it leads to places of learning, and that makes us human. and it connects us one to another. So thank you all for this.
Thanks time. For being with us again, Alyssa. It was great. Barbara, great to see you again. Brandon, always good to see you, bud. Continue to get strong and better.
Thank you, Alyssa. Thank you so much for both this and the episode. Look forward to future partnerships. And Barbara, please come back. This was great.
Yeah, no, I'm so glad I found you guys.
Yeah,
Us too, absolutely.
Beautiful. Bye-bye.
If you like what you hear, you can support What in God's Name on Patreon. Sign up for our newsletter on our website, whatingods.com. You can support Alyssa and her work at the website she mentioned.
If you have time later, ipmforwomen.org/stitchingstories.